Chapter 41. But in my sketches, Chocolate the Laundress, as the bay calls her, she can't say Charlotte. Still taller, still more majestic of proportions, turbaned, very black, straight as an Indian, age 24. Then there was the farmer's wife, colored, and her little girl, Susie. Wasn't it a good audience to get up an excitement before? Good excitable inflammable material? Lewis was still downtown, 3 miles away, with his 2-horse wagon, to get a load of manure. Lewis is the farmer, colored. He is of mighty frame and muscle, stocky, stooping, ungainly, has a good manly face and a clear eye. Age about 45 and the most picturesque of men, when he sits in his fluttering workday rags, humped forward into a bunch, with his aged slouch hat mashed down over his ears and neck. It is a spectacle to make the broken-hearted smile. Lewis has worked mighty hard and remained mighty poor. At the end of each whole year's toil he can't show a gain of $50. He had borrowed money of the Cranes till he owed them $700, and he, being conscientious and honest, imagine what it was to him to have to carry his stubborn, helpless load year in and year out. Well, sunset came, and Ida, the young and comely Charlie Langdon's wife, and her little Julia and the nurse Nora, drove out at the gate behind the new gray horse, and started down the long hill, the high carriage receiving its load under the portcocher. Ida was seen to turn her face toward us across the fence, and intervening lawn, Theodore waved goodbye to her, for he did not know that her sign was a speechless appeal for help. The next moment Livy said, "Ida's driving too fast downhill." She followed it with a sort of scream, "Her horse is running away." We could see 200 yards down that descent. The buggy seemed to fly. It would strike obstructions and apparently spring the height of a man from the ground. Theodore and I left the shrieking crowd behind, and ran down the hill bareheaded and shouting. A neighbor appeared at his gate a tenth of a second too late. The buggy vanished past him like a thought. My last glimpse showed it for one instant, far down the descent, springing high in the air out of a cloud of dust, and then it disappeared. As I flew down the road, my impulse was to shut my eyes as I turned them to the right or left, and so delay for a moment the ghastly spectacle of mutilation and death I was expecting. I ran on and on, still spared this spectacle, but saying to myself, "I shall see it at the turn of the road. They never can pass that turn alive." When I came in sight of that turn, I saw two wagons there bunched together, one of them full of people. I said, "Just so, they are staring petrified at the remains." But when I got amongst that bunch, there sat Ida in her buggy and nobody hurt, not even the horse or the vehicle. Ida was pale but serene. As I came tearing down, she smiled back over her shoulder at me and said, "Well, we're alive yet, aren't we?" A miracle had been performed, nothing else. You see, Lewis, the prodigious, humped upon his front seat, had been toiling up on his load of manure. He saw the frantic horse plunging down the hill toward him, on a full gallop, throwing his heels as high as a man's head at every jump. So Lewis turned his team diagonally across the road just at the turn, thus making a 5. With the fence, the running horse could not escape that, but must enter it. Then Lewis sprang to the ground and stood in this 5. He gathered his vast strength, and with a perfect Creedmoor aim he seized the gray horse's bit as he plunged by, and fetched him up standing. It was downhill, mind you. 10 feet further downhill, neither Lewis nor any other man could have saved them, for they would have been on the abrupt turn then. But how this miracle was ever accomplished at all, by human strength, generalship, and accuracy, is clean beyond my comprehension, and grows more so the more I go and examine the ground, and try to believe it was actually done. I know one thing, well, if Lewis had missed his aim, he would have been killed on the spot in the trap he had made for himself, and we should have found the rest of the remains away down at the bottom of the steep ravine. 10 minutes later, Theodore and I arrived opposite the house, with the servants straggling after us, and shouted to the distracted group on the porch, "Everybody safe!" Believe it? Why, how could they? They knew the road perfectly. We might as well have said it to people who had seen their friends go over Niagara. However, we convinced them, and then, instead of saying something, or going on crying, they grew very still. Words could not express it, I suppose. Nobody could do anything that night, or sleep either, but there was a deal of moving talk, with long pauses between pictures of that flying carriage. These pauses represented this picture intruded itself all the time, and disjointed the talk. But yesterday evening late, when Lewis arrived from downtown, he found his supper spread, and some presents of books there, with very complimentary writings on the fly leaves, and certain very complimentary letters, and more or less greenbacks of dignified denomination pinned to these letters and fly leaves, and one said, among other things, signed by the Cranes, E. Cancel $400 of your indebtedness to us, and C, the end thereof is not yet, of course, for Charlie Langdon is west, and will arrive ignorant of all these things, today. The supper room had been kept locked, and imposingly secret and mysterious until Lewis should arrive, but around that part of the house were gathered Lewis's wife and child, Chocolate, Josie, Auntie Cord and Rosa, canvassing things and waiting impatiently. They were all on hand when the curtain rose. Now, Auntie Cord is a violent Methodist and Lewis an implacable Dunker Baptist. Those two are inveterate religious disputants. The revealments having been made, Auntie Cord said with effusion, "Now, let folks go on saying there ain't no God. Lewis, the Lord sent you there to stop that horse." Says Lewis. "Then who sent the horse there in such a shape? But I want to call your attention to one thing. When Lewis arrived the other evening, after saving those lives by a feat which I think is the most marvelous of any I can call to mind, when he arrived, hunched up on his manure wagon, and as grotesquely picturesque as usual, everybody wanted to go and see how he looked. They came back and said he was beautiful. It was so, too, and yet he would have photographed exactly as he would have done any day these past 7 years that he has occupied this farm. August 27. P.S. Our little romance in real life is happily and satisfactorily completed. Charlie has come, listened, acted, and now John T. Lewis has ceased to consider himself as belonging to that class called the poor. It has been known, during some years, that it was Lewis's purpose to buy a $30 silver watch someday, if he ever got where he could afford it. Today Ida has given him a new, sumptuous gold Swiss stem winding stopwatch. And if any scoffer shall say, "Behold, this thing is out of character," there is an inscription within, which will silence him, for it will teach him that this wearer aggrandizes the watch, not the watch the wearer. I was asked beforehand if this would be a wise gift, and I said, "S, the very wisest of all. I know the colored race, and I know that in Lewis's eyes this fine toy will throw the other more valuable testimonials far away into the shade. If he lived in England, the Humane Society would give him a gold medal as costly as this watch, and nobody would say colon it is out of character. If Lewis chose to wear a town clock, who would become it better? Lewis has sound common sense, and is not going to be spoiled. The instant he found himself possessed of money, he forgot himself in a plan to make his old father comfortable, who is wretchedly poor, and lives down in Maryland. His next act, on the spot, was the proffer to the Cranes of the $300 of his remaining indebtedness to them. This was put off by them to the indefinite future, for he is not going to be allowed to pay that at all, though he doesn't know it. A letter of acknowledgement from Lewis contains a sentence which raises it to the dignity of literature. But I beg to say, humbly, that inasmuch as divine providence saw fit to use me as an instrument for the saving of those precious lives, the honor conferred upon me was greater than the feat performed. That is well said. Ears ever mark. Howells was moved to use the story in the Contributors Club, and warned Clemens against letting it get into the newspapers. He declared he thought it one of the most impressive things he had ever read. But Clemens seems never to have allowed it to be used in any form. In its entirety, therefore, it is quite new matter. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, September 19, 1877. My dear Howells, I don't really see how the story of the runaway horse could read well with the little details of names and places and things left out. They are the true life of all narrative. It wouldn't quite do to print them at this time. We'll talk about it when you come. Delicacy, a sad false delicacy, robs literature of the best two things among its belongings. Family circle narrative and obscene stories. But no matter, in that better world which I trust we are all going to, I have the hope and belief that they will not be denied us. Say, Twitchell and I had an adventure at sea, 4 months ago, which I did not put in my Bermuda articles, because there was not enough to it. But the press dispatches bring the sequel today, and now there's plenty to it. A sailless, wasteless, chartless, compassless, grubless old condemned tub that has been drifting helpless about the ocean for 4 months and a half, begging bread and water like any other tramp, flying a signal of distress permanently, and with 13 innocent, marveling chuckle-headed Bermuda niggers on board, taking a pleasure excursion. Our ship fed the poor devils on the 25th of last May, far out at sea, and left them to bullyrack their way to New York, and now they ain't as near New York as they were then by 250 miles. They have drifted 750 miles, and are still drifting in the relentless Gulf Stream. What a delicious magazine! Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.